I wanted to throw him down so hard, the earth cracked. I wanted to break something for needing him so badly. I wanted him to break me, too, for him to sink his teeth into my neck, or breasts, or thighs. After so long thinking there was sacrality in drowning, I worried nothing was divine unless it arrived on the beckoning hand of pain. But then I thought of that first time at Petula Hall, when we'd gone slow, when we'd been witness, pupil, visitor, then craftsman of each other's pleasure, when the little deaths had come again and again, and there had been no pain upon their wings. Not everything had to hurt to be holy, bad to be good. But damn me if I wanted it to sometimes. In the morning, I woke in my room to a blushing dawn, turned over in bed, and saw that the gargoyle was gone. "Sybil?" Maud sat up. "What's wrong?" "He's missing." I couldn't catch my breath. It was like waking up in my diviner cottage and finding that 4, 2, 3, 5, then 1 had vanished. My gargoyle! He was here when I got back from the beach last night, and now he's... I put a hand to my chest. Lost. Maud braced the frame of her bed to get up, but I was already throwing on a tunic, bursting from our room, out of the inn, and into morning light. And all while I looked for the gargoyle, through crofts, through sheep-speckled fields and hills of thrift flowers, climbing higher and higher, I was thinking on lost things, on death, on how I'd searched the hamlets, like I searched now, and hadn't found a single one of my darling diviners to put back into my arms, how fate was cruel, life frail, and how lonely it felt, in the vastness of Traum, that the only person I'd come close to finding was myself. I sobbed like a child. Then, at the tallest cliff, in a bed of flowers, I saw him, looking out over the dawn, the sea, the edge of the world, hands folded delicately in his lap, utterly content. "Oh, you stupid, stupid gargoyle!" I ran to him, threw my arms around his shoulders, bruised myself on his body for holding so tightly. "Why did you leave and not say anything?" He blinked.
"Are you crying, Bartholomew?"
"Of course I am, you dingbat!" I didn't know if he fully understood why I was upset, but he seemed pleased to be the one to comfort and not the one to cry, because his shoulders straightened and he began to hum.
"I think," he said, when my breath had finally soothed, "that we were never meant to stay so long behind that stone wall, Bartholomew."
He rested his heavy head on mine.
"Thank you for bringing me with you. I don't think I would have been brave enough to leave the Tor alone."
I held his hand and we looked out over the view. "Why did you come out here?"
"I am a battlefield of admiration."
He nodded at the horizon.
"I cannot decide which I like best, the sunrise or the sunset. They are like life and her quiet companion, death."
We watched the sunrise over the sea. I leaned against his shoulder. "Do you still think about Aisling, gargoyle?"
"Endlessly."
He stretched his wings, yawned.
"The Tor was the only home I ever knew, but I have stepped down from its height and seen the world with my own eyes. You can't take something like that back. Even if I returned to the cathedral, nothing can be as it was."
His fangs pressed over his teeth as he smiled.
"You can never really go home."
"Rather a tragic way to see things, don't you think?" He patted my leg.
"You sound troubled."
"Aren't you?"
"Often, but also rarely."
I keep my eyes upon the vast, liminal sea, thought of life and death and the diviners. We'll go to the cliffs of Belladine and look out over the sighing sea, all six of us. We'll shout so loud and long that our echoes will sound behind us. We'll lie under the stars on beds of pink thrift flowers and stain our teeth with wine. We'll sleep, but never dream. I stood, walked to the edge of the cliff, and shouted. It came from deep in my belly, a forlorn yell that sounded so loud and so long that it put a buzz in my ears, its echo devouring the sighing sea, the cliffs of Belladine, all of Traum, perhaps. And I thought, maybe the life of Sybil Delling was paid for with the death of Six's dreams, that it wasn't just the omens that weren't real, but the stories I'd told myself, that I had to suffer to earn a home at Ashling Cathedral, that I had to hide my face and name to be useful, to be strong, to be special, that the diviners and I would spend our lives together, that our sisterhood was eternal. But nothing was eternal, and I could never go back home. Death fluttered over the world like a breeze, stirring our hair, and I knew it well. I'd quested through Traum, battled omens, sprites, loneliness and longing. I'd made the agonizing pilgrimage from Six to Sybil. That was death in and of itself. But just on the other side of it, waiting behind Gossamer, was life, too. I reached into my hair, took off my shroud, held it out over the edge of the cliff. When the wind took it in its teeth, I did not resist. I simply let go. I watched as my shroud fluttered away, as if on pale wings. It flew and it flew until I couldn't see it anymore, because the light over the sea was so bright. I cried, just a little. When I turned, the gargoyle was there, smiling at me. So was Maud. Rory, too. Oh! I wiped tears from my cheeks and levied a threatening finger. Don't you dare say anything. But the threat fell flat. I was smiling right back at them. Rory bridged the distance between us. Morning light warmed his face. His dark hair caught the wind, and when he looked at me with unmasked adoration, I felt an instant tightness in my chest. He leaned over in his usual idle way, took my cheek in his hand, said, "Just as well. I don't have the words." I kissed him, and he kissed me back harder, and we stood upon the cliff, on what felt like the edge of the world, wind-blown and breathless, and new. Maud hugged the gargoyle, and he clapped. The ceremony, put on by the noble families of the Cliffs of Belladine to mark the arrival of a new king, was delayed. For the rest of the day, it stormed. I waited for Benji to find me and Rory and Maud, to meet with us, as he had with Hamelin and the others last night. But he did not. He kept to his quarters, while the rest of the knights, restless, shuffled through the inn where we stayed. I thought of staying in my quarters, too, afraid to show my stone eyes. But I had banished my shroud to the wind, let go of Six entirely. There was nothing to hide beneath now. I sat by the fire with Maud and the gargoyle, while Rory read a book of poetry aloud, making faces whenever the author said anything too amorous, then tossed the book aside with a snort. The gargoyle picked it up, held it upside down, and spent the next quarter hour hemming and hawing over it, pretending to read. The knights stared at me. Travellers who stopped in the inn, too. They searched my stone eyes just as pointedly as they once had my shroud, with grotesque fascination or fear, until a murderous glower from Rory or Maud sent their gazes to the wall. And while I was not so restless as I'd been in the Chiming Wood, waiting for the king's ceremony or an opportunity to snare an omen, there was a thrumming disquiet in my body. An internal warning I could not translate. Hours later, well into the night, I lay in bed in my room, still awake. Maud was snoring in the bed next to me, and the gargoyle muttered in his sleep. Rain sprayed the window, Thunder rolled. The darkness perforated every handful of minutes by the flash of lightning. It was far from a quiet night. Still, I heard it, a strange noise just outside the door. Clack, clack. I went still, listening. There it was again, footsteps in the dark. Not a thump, like a cobbled shoe or boot, or even a bare foot might make, but harsh, like stone upon stone. Clack, clack. Clack, clack. The door creaked open. A figure in a hooded grey cloak came into the room. Its steps were heavy, the wood groaning in its wake. I lay frozen beneath my blankets, listening as it drew closer and closer to me. There was a low rasp, quick, laboured breaths. Then the figure was leaning over my bed, standing directly over the gargoyle. I couldn't see its face. I couldn't see anything. But then lightning flashed, the sky a blinding white. I caught a glimpse of a face hidden beneath the shadow of a hood, and screamed. The figure turned, ran for the door. I jolted out of bed and reached out, grasping at it. My hand closed around an arm so hard my fingernails broke. The figure jerked away, its arm flinging out and striking me along the shoulder with bruising force. Maud sat up, and the gargoyle shrieked, throwing his blanket aside. Lightning flashed once more, illuminating our room and everyone in it. Only now, the hooded figure was gone. Chapter 27. Love and Heartbreak. I woke with a terrible ache. The whole of my body was rigid, my muscles hard and overstrained. I let out a creaking groan, sat up. Someone cleared their throat. Maud was sitting on her bed, Benji beside her. He was wearing a beautiful tunic, woven in intricate patterns, dyed astounding colours. The gargoyle sat on the floor next to him, staring at it in a quiet daze. Rory was near, standing tall, a shadow over my bed. They were all watching me. Pith. I pulled my blanket to my chin. I wasn't wearing a shirt. I'd taken it off to examine the mark on my shoulder the hooded figure had left last night when I'd tried to stop them from fleeing. A truly spectacular bruise sat on my collarbone, the skin an ugly shade of purple. Happily, nothing seemed broken. You needn't all be here. I told you last night I'm
Say fine, and I'll combust.
Rory reached down, gingerly moving the blanket and examining my bruise.
Well.
His voice was far too calm. He bent, ghosting his lips over damaged skin.
If it was indeed the Heartsore Weaver, I'm going to enjoy killing her.
He raised himself, kissing my neck as he went, the air between us immediately warm.
Was she very terrible?
Benji asked, his voice slow, quiet, as he beheld my stone eyes for the first time.
The Weaver.
I hardly saw anything besides a face. It wasn't... I frowned. The harried scribe and ardent oarsman were horrible to look at, but I could still see some humanness in their faces. But the Heartsore Weaver, she didn't look human at all. It wasn't just her eyes that were stone, more like her entire face, a strange, distorted face.
Did she say anything?
Maud asked. No.
Likely wanted to eat you, Benji muttered. Did that really need to be said? Rory snapped.
Anyway, the king ran a hand down the back of his neck. We'll catch up with her, lure her out with spring water during the ceremony, like we did the oarsmen. We all nodded. And while you all are engaging in heroics, Benji swished his colourful tunic, I'll be paraded about in this. Apparently, Tori Bassett's mother made it especially for me. He frowned. Not sure what it's for.
At least one of us is dressed, Maud said. I can hear the knighthood rumbling about. I need to change my bandages, and Rory's not in his armor yet.
I'm not in anything, I muttered.
And I'm not complaining, Rory said. I slapped his arm, and he grinned. No one expects you to still come to the ceremony, Maud, Benji said gently. You can stay and rest if you...
I say this with love, Benedict Castor.
She pinched his cheek.
Shut up.
I'm a knight, and I will attend your ceremony with the rest of the knighthood. In fact, both of you, she grinned, kindly fuck off. The gargoyle was Maud's squire, as well as mine. He was helping her tie her boots and making a pig's ear of it when I stepped out of the room, surprised to find Benji still there.
Six.
He smiled, then nodded at the door. Do you mind?
I shut it.
I wanted to clear the air after the other night. I looked for the boy in Benji. The easy smile, the eagerness in his blue eyes. But they were hard to find. Now his gaze was clouded, his smile practiced. Hamelin's, well, he's not the charmer he imagines, but his mother is the wealthiest woman in the Fervent Peaks. Dedric Lange's family owns half the Siege, and Tory Bassett is a fearsome fighter. Loyalty is political. Being their friend has its advantages.
I imagined it did. Not at the cost of your friendship with Rory, I hope.
Of course not. But Rory... His cheeks went red, his gaze falling to his shoes in a sudden discomfort. Well, to tell you the truth, I've always looked up to Rory. Tradition, virtue, loyalty, those things don't touch him. You saw how he was when I knighted you, nitpicking what you should or should not swear to. He was like that with his own vows as well, despite the fact that it was my grandfather who saved him.
Benji paused, clearing his throat.
What I mean is, I envy him his freedom. Rory keeps his own rules, beholden to nothing and no one.
I'll do anything you ask of me.
I frowned. Perhaps always looking up to him means you do not see him clearly. Rory is the most loyal person I know.
Benji's gaze lifted. Perhaps.
Then, like the storm that had passed over the cliffs of Belladine, the clouds were gone from the king's eyes. He seemed like himself again, lively and eager.
Where's your shroud?
Gone. He did not look upset that I'd flouted his wishes, nor was he repulsed or afraid to look at my eyes. The king looked almost awestruck.
Stone eyes, he murmured. As ever, you're wildly intimidating. A desirable trait, one I'll use to my advantage when I sit on the throne back at Castle Lurik.
He looked down at his ceremonial tunic.
Rather unlike me, wearing a glorified quilt.
I suppose I should be happy that this hamlet does not require me to be naked and cast into freezing water. He squeezed my hand and dropped it.
See you out there.
Benji, I swallowed. I don't know if I'll be joining you at Castle Lurik. His eyes went blank, and I took a steadying breath. That is, my focus is ever on Aisling. On putting my hammer and chisel upon it, and destroying everything the omens have built. What comes after, I don't know, only that I've learned not to promise a future that may not come to be.
He stayed quiet a long moment.
Did Rory tell you to say that?
What?
No, I just... Traum is a dangerous place, Diviner. Benji's voice softened. There are terrible sprites, terrible folk, too. But with me, you will be safe. You will garner the power, the awe, the respect you are due.
He reached out, patted my shoulder.
Everything will turn out well. Have a little faith.
My muscles tensed. And if I still wish to find my future away from Castle Lurik?
Benji met my gaze, smiled.
Then, of course, I will let you go.
He bowed, then turned down the corridor. I watched him walk away, something cold, chafing inside of me. It was the first ceremony I'd attended, where the entire hamlet was welcome. Folks of the Cliffs of Belladine wore their finest knits, woven and dyed tunics similar to the one Benji wore.
They joined the king and his knights, and together, like a herd of colourful lambs, we moved to a hedge that had been made to grow in the shape of a circle, a mile west of the inn. There were elders, barefoot children, young girls who threw flowers, and young boys with sunlit eyes who looked up with longing at the knights and their armour and their weapons. Folk were wary of the gargoyle, but only at first.
"Is it a sprite?"
a little girl with silver hair like mine asked.
"Does it bite?"
"It is a he, and I believe he is a very old kind of sprite," I called back. "And yes, I'm afraid he's known to bite."
"Slanderous imp, I am not."
The gargoyle smiled at the girl, his fangs on full display. I worried she'd cry, but she giggled, then gave the gargoyle a crown of pink flowers. When we reached the hedge, we spread out around it. I made sure to stand on the north side, where the gargoyle and I could see the sea, and Rory and Maud came to stand next to us. "Everyone here looks rather cheery," I said, narrowing my eyes. "It's alarming." Benji and five women, all wearing brightly dyed knits, entered the hedge's circle through a narrow gate, then moved to stand in the heart of it. The women made their own circle around the king. I recognized the one who ran the inn, who'd smiled at me that first rainy day. When she addressed the crowd, her voice was frayed by age, wobbly, but still harmonious. "I'm Brenna Bassett. My family have lived along the cliffs of Belladine for over 200 years. We've seen many kings. When a new one arrives, weavers like me have stood in this spot and said the Heartsore Weaver is the truest omen, that only love, only heartbreak, can weave the thread of all that came and all that is yet to come." She paused. "But really, who are we kidding? We don't have time to weigh the merits of gods or which is best. We hardly look to portents at all. We're too busy trying not to break the bloody loom." The crowd laughed. "But," Brenna Bassett continued, "but there is something to be said about love. Be it for ardour or sorrow, love is like the Heartsore Weaver, like an omen. Its signs are everywhere. We may seek it, create it, feel it, ignore it, or lose it, but it is always there. Love is like our loomstone. It keeps us rooted to the world, to one another." The crowd nodded along, but I held perfectly still, listening. "The truth is," Brenna said, "we of the cliffs of Belladine are not too busy to look for the Heartsore Weaver's signs of love and heartbreak. We do look for them. The world is a frightful place." She found me in the crowd, nodded. "Divination is a gift we give ourselves, that we might avoid the pain that comes from living, from loving, if we see it coming. But I like to think there are times when the thread of our faith in love is so resolute that we forget to search for signs." She nodded to the crowd. "When a babe learns to walk, when friends gather around a sickbed or deathbed and sew a patch onto the family blanket, a couple's kiss on their wedding day and the night that follows. We do not look for love or heartbreak because they, like the truest God, are ever with us." She smiled. "And it's a privilege to know them." She approached Benji. "Thank you for honoring us with your presence, Benedict Castor. May you know love and heartbreak in your kingship, and may we together be witnesses to its wonders, pupils of its portents." She raised her hands. "Ever but visitors." Benji sounded a little breathless. "Ever but visitors. Ever but visitors," the crowd echoed.
"Ever but visitors,"
the gargoyle cheered. The five women reached for Benji's tunic. From its collar, its sleeves, its bottom hem, they each pulled free a thread, then tied that thread to their ring fingers and brought their hands to their hearts. They began taking small, incremental steps back, and the tunic, all that beautiful stitching, became undone. It was the first ceremony that had held me wrapped. I watched Benji let his arms fall to his sides, the weavers stitching, their hard work unspooling around him, and felt strangely moved. They did not make a spectacle of their king, or their faith, or their craft. No one was put low so that the hearts or weaver, the omens, might be lifted. No hurt was tended for the sake of holiness. It felt unexpectedly hallowed. Rory leaned close.
You're frowning.
I did not expect it to be so lovely and gentle, I said, the bruise on my shoulder from last night throbbing, for such an abrasive omen. The threads pulled and pulled, and while Benji's tunic unspooled around him, bearing his chest to us witnesses, he was not made prostrate for it. He seemed almost comfortable, eyes shut, shoulders eased, as if heartened to feel the sun on his skin. I kept frowning. Rory. His gauntlet scraped against mine.
Hmm?
What will happen when the king is finished taking up the mantle? When he has all the stone objects, and Ashling loses its power? The journey through Traum was ending. My fruitless quest to find my friends, my sworn retribution against the omens, nearly over. Something new was drawing nigh, but I could not tell what it was, only that its shapelessness unnerved me. Rory searched my face.
Whatever you wish. The world is yours, Sybil.
I watched Benji, standing in the heart of the hedge, like I'd once stood upon Ashling's chancel. Trouble is, I wouldn't know where to go if I wasn't following the knights.
You can go anywhere you like. You have the gargoyle, your armor, your hammer, chisel.
He looked into my eyes, said so very plainly,
and you have me.
My frown vanished. I can't ask you to leave the knighthood.
Because you know I'd say yes.
Because the king relies on you. I can't ask you to choose between...
You don't have to.
His eyes were so dark, so soft.
I've already chosen.
The frail tapestry of my soul expanded. Won't Benji be upset to lose you?
It's not a death, just a departure. Besides, Benji doesn't need me the way he thinks he does. He's stronger than he realizes.
Rory nodded at the hedge, and the king at the heart of it.
He knows I care about him. He'll understand.
Will he?
He'll have to. A knighthood is not a yoke. I'm no one's drudge.
The corners of his mouth lifted.
But I'll be your errand boy, if you ask me nicely.
You're such an idiot, I said, smiling like one, as I looked out over the sea. Thank you. He nodded, a hint of rose in his cheeks. He'd seen me naked, put his hands and mouth on me. And I marveled at this, standing with me in full armor, talking of the future, our future, should be the thing to make Roderick Mendacious blush. The threads of Benji's tunic were all around, catching the wind, and all of them strong. Something I'd once considered a good portent. I didn't need it now. I knew exactly how to read the signs, knew exactly what was going to happen to me. It was happening right now. I was falling in love. We watched the ceremony until Benji's tunic was but 5 long threads. Folk in the crowd took hold of those threads, dancing in crooked lines around the hedge. The gargoyle danced with them, hopping and giggling. Maud and Benji stood aside with the rest of the knights, silently nodding at Rory and me as we disappeared over a bluff, Ashling's spring water in a flask upon Rory's belt. We put it on a rock among thrift flowers, undid its lid, hid behind another rock, and remained unmoving. We waited, waited. The Heartsore Weaver did not come. 2 hours later, I yawned. Maybe I dreamed her up last night. Rory shook his head.
That bruise is real enough.
Spring water worked for the scribe, the oarsman. I peered at the flask upon the rock. Why won't the weaver come? He didn't answer, worrying his thumb over his coin. Then, when the first star touched the sky,
What are you two loitering around for?
Rory swore, and I jumped, the two of us turning. The gargoyle was there, trilling his claws happily as he waved at us. Maud and Benji, too. They carried the omen stone objects with them. Maud used the ardent oarsman's oar as a walking stick, and Benji bore the harried scribe's inkwell, the faithful forester's chime roped tightly on his belt. The king wore leathers and a breastplate. The ceremony is over, he called. I sent the knights back to the inn. When he approached, his gaze shifted between Rory and me. Any luck spotting the Heartsaw Weaver? I shook my head.
That's because you are not looking in the right place.
Just as quickly as he'd arrived, the gargoyle sauntered off.
This way, chickens.
We stared after him. Do you even know who we're looking for? Maud hollered at his back.
Of course I do. I know everything, and I know it exceedingly well. So come.
We four shared a bewildered look, but Rory shrugged, Maud snagged the flask of spring water and fastened it to her belt, and then we were stepping on the same trodden flowers the gargoyle had crushed, hurrying after him. He led us down a hill and up another, past a croft, until we were on the same cliff he'd gone to yesterday morning, where he'd looked out at the dawn. He stood next to an old grey rock, turned to us, and held out his arms.
I will now accept your applause.
Rory looked around, saw nothing, clapped with painful slowness. I let out a sigh. We're not here to admire the sunset, Gargoyle.
I did not bring you to see the sunset, Bartholomew.
He nodded at the earth near our feet.
I brought you to see what's beneath it.
Silence. Then Benji turned his head. What's that sound? Can't hear anything. Maud put a hand to her bandaged side and winced. If you dragged me up that hill again for nothing, all I hear is the ocean, I snapped. Rory pulled me into the crook of his arm and stamped his palm over my lips. Shh, listen. I made a note to bite him later and went quiet. At first there was nothing, just the murmur of the wind through grass and the hum of the sea and an invigorated owl hooting in the distance. But just as I was about to sink my teeth into Rory's palm, another sound called, closer than all those others. Lapping water, coming from directly beneath us. Rory and I both looked down at the stone next to the gargoyle's feet and dropped to our knees. And I saw that the impression in the grass was slightly off. The stone had been moved, revealing a sliver of darkness in the ground. There's something under it, Benji said. Rory dropped to a crouch. He grasped the stone, made a low sound of effort I liked far too well. Oh, let me. I added my fingers to his and lifted. The stone was heavy.
No one's as strong as you, is that it? He said, straining.
We both lifted it in the end, but the effort to toss it aside was all mine. Rory smirked.
Boastfulness is ignoble.
And you love it.
Maud joined us where the stone had been. In its place was a hole in the cliff, wide enough to fit my body. We gathered around it. It was like looking down a long, dark throat. The sound of lapping water was louder now. I could smell the salt of the sea, see the faintest reflection of water, 12 or so hands below us. My grandfather's notebook didn't say anything about caves beneath the cliffs of Belladine, Benji said. Maud sucked her teeth. How do we even know the Heartsaw Weaver's inside? This is what my dream looks like, I murmured. It's dark, the only light coming from cracks above. I slam into a stone bench, and there's a tapestry. That's where I see the loom stone. Then, I rubbed the prickles off the back of my neck. There are footsteps, heavy, like the ones I heard last night. A sharp, clacking noise right behind me, but I never see who's chasing me. The others stared. Well, Benji's throat worked as he swallowed. That's quite the dream.
It's the most horrifying thing I've ever heard.
Rory was fidgeting so madly with his coin, it was a wonder he didn't accidentally propel himself through space.
I hate tight, dark places.
Let's hope you never die, the gargoyle said. I hear graves are rather constrictive.
Rory's eyelids drew low. Helpful. I looked down into the darkness. How did you know this was here, Gargoyle?
I told you, Bartholomew. I know everything I know exceedingly well.
He came to the lip of the hole, sniffed the air.
Rather fusty.
He turned to me.
Shall we draw straws to see who will go down first? Or will you just cheat and choose the short straw on purpose like you always do?
I don't always. Benji's voice was a taut string. I'll go.
Calm down, Your Majesty. Let your ignoble knight go first.
Even in the dim light, I could see the warmth in Rory's face was gone. He looked down at the blackness with a jaw of iron, sat down on the grass and threw his legs into the hole. Rory, wait! I caught his shoulder. I can do it.
I know you can, Sybil.
He took my hand off his shoulder and brought it to his mouth, pressed his lips over my armored knuckles. But for fuck's sake, permit me. He jumped. Time held me by the throat. Rory! His boots hit rocks and he coughed.
Rory!
Maud hollered.
I'm right here.
His voice ricocheted off the walls of the cavern, near and far. Come down, I'll catch you. I sighed, sat and swung my legs into the hole. Let's kill another omen.
Huzzah!
The gargoyle clapped and gave me an excited shove. Chapter 28. The Heartsaw Weaver. The air was close, smelling sharp like salt water and overripe like decay. I fell, heart in my throat, and then Rory was there, his strong arms folding around me.
I've got you.
The gargoyle came next, though it took him a moment to squeeze his wings through the narrow hole. When he fell into the cavern, splashing Rory and me with water, he let out a raucous squeal.
And I thought flying was unsavory, but crawling in the earth like an insect. Ugh! Bartholomew, look! A worm!
Rory put his hand over the gargoyle's mouth. The point of a hunt, he said, is to catch your prey unsuspectingly. Be quiet or send yourself back up that hole.
And abandon Bartholomew to the omen who tried to smite her last night.
The gargoyle batted Rory away.
What kind of squire would that make me?
A good squire is a silent squire,
says the knight without one.
Both of you, shut it. I squinted against darkness. The gargoyle had been right. There were worms in the cavern, luminous green and blue and purple worms that lit the darkness, clinging to dripping mossy walls, climbing over lichen, over rocks. And while the dissonance of lapping water blighted most of the sound around us, I heard a small hum. The barest hint of a noise coming from the worms. They're sprites, I whispered. Tiny silkworm sprites. Rory and the gargoyle raised their eyes to the looming walls of the cavern. Pitch black, it stretched on and on, and would have been impossible to navigate at night without a lantern. But the sprites, their small glowing bodies, cast an ethereal glow, like stars punctuating a moonless sky, affording us a view of a wide, vast space.
Look out below!
Benji didn't jump. He travelled on the magical tide of the inkwell, appearing before us. Maud came after him, and Rory caught her, and she winced in pain. It's massive. She peered at the walls around us. It must have taken centuries for the sea to wear down all this rock. How could someone live like this? Benji asked, the cave throwing his echo back at him. Ever in the dark?
You'd be surprised, Rory murmured.
We struck out. Rory led, coin in hand, and I followed closely, gripping my hammer and chisel. Behind me was Maud, then the king, then the gargoyle at the rear.
So you're really not going to tell us how you knew this was here? Maud asked him.
I should think it's rather obvious.
I promise, Benji said. It isn't. Quiet. I perked my ear. Listen. There. A harsh sound, and its echoes. Clack, clack. Do you hear that?
Rory's gaze narrowed.
Yes.
The cavern was widening, diverting. We passed pools of dank, stagnant water. Ahead, the sprites glowed fewer, scattered. Everything was colder, darker. Rory stopped. Ahead, three separate tunnels loomed, like valves into a black heart.
Which way now, all-knowing gargoyle? Maud said.
He made a contemplative hmm.
Perhaps those weavings will instruct us.
I hadn't seen them at first. They were worn and wet and growing velvety moss, just like the walls of the cavern. But the closer I got, yes, there were weavings on the wall. Three of them, each the size of a child's blanket. Worn down by time and the salt and the air, the coloured dye had all but faded, the thread long frayed. Still, I noted how fine the stitches were, how intricate the braided patterns.
They're pictures, Rory said.
So they were. The first was of worms, hundreds of them, crawling over walls. The second picture was of small, pale clusters hanging from thread over a fire. The third... I felt my pulse kick. The third was of moths fluttering over a stone slab. She's a silk weaver. Benji pointed at the weavings. The worm grows, the cocoon is boiled, those that remain become moths.
Grotesque, educational, yet uninstructive, Rory said. We still don't know which path to take.
There are five of us. Maud's knuckles were white as she leaned on the stone oar. She nodded at the first tunnel. Benji and I will take this one. You and Sybil take the second. The gargoyle...
No one travels alone, I said. The gargoyle comes with me.
The moth,
the gargoyle whispered, turning to the third tunnel.
We'll follow the moth.
It was the darkest of the three paths, the tightest. When I stepped toward it, breathed its damp air, it was as if someone had put wet cloth over my mouth and nostrils.
Meet back here in 20 minutes, and we'll explore the final tunnel together, Rory said, taking my hand. If one group is not back, the other comes after them.
Benji's eyes lowered to our hands together. 20 minutes. Maud gave us one of her reassuring grins, and then she and the king were disappearing down the first tunnel, and Rory, the gargoyle, and I, into the third. Darkness closed its fist around us. The path sloped downward, deeper into the earth. I could touch both sides of the tunnel with my arms spread, and Rory had to slouch so as not to strike his head. Can't see an inch in front of my nose. His breaths were fast, labored. You all right? He didn't answer. Then, just stay close to me. The gargoyle, undisturbed by the gloom, hummed to himself.
She did her best to spruce the place up, didn't she? The old hardsaw weaver.
I peered over my shoulder. He was running his claws over both sides of the tunnel, snagging over a long, thick thread I had not noticed.
And look, she made a happy little rope to guide herself on dark nights like this.
He gave the thread on the left a tug, ripping it entirely from the cave wall.
Not very sturdy.
A deep groan sounded from above. Rory and the gargoyle and I went rigid. I heard, then smelled, water rushing, far away at first, then closer, closer, until it was right behind us. We turned. A wall of water came careening toward us. Rory was shouting, and I was ushering the gargoyle forward, and then all three of us were sprinting into darkness. But whatever pool had been emptied into our tunnel came on a monstrous current. The water caught us, threw our feet out from under us. We were swept into blackness, faster, faster. And then we were falling. We hit something hard, a loud ting sounding. Gold, I realized. We'd fallen onto a vast bed of gold at the bottom of a pit, a hole in the tunnel, water pouring over us in a torrid rush. I lost Rory, lost the gargoyle, coughed and spluttered. Salt water shot into my eyes and nose and mouth. I fought against the current, desperate to find my feet. But the water kept rising. I choked on Rory's name. The water held me down, and so did my armor, and I was seized with the vibrant horror that I might easily drown like this. Weighed down without purchase, unable to stand, unable to swim. A hand found the nape of my neck, pulled me up. Rory was coughing too, struggling like me to keep his feet in the pit of slippery coins, with water pressing down on him. He shouted over the din, "Are you hurt?" I shook my head. We held on to each other, steadfast as we pulled, each the other's perfect counterbalance, until we found our feet. When I looked up, I saw that the water was not so torrid as before, running out of furious pressure.
"I say, Bartholomew."
The gargoyle called from the lip of the pit. He hadn't fallen in. He'd flown to the other edge, the prat, and looked furious to be wet.
"Are you quite well?"
"Right as rain," I snapped. I looked to Rory and let out a sharp cry. I could see it, even in the dim light, even with water in my eyes. A massive dent in Rory's breastplate. He gasped for air.
"Keep your balance. There are pikes at the bottom of this pit."
I swore, then shouted once more at the gargoyle. "Throw something down to us."
"There's a hefty weave of rope here."
"Oh, but Bartholomew," he screamed. "There are worms on it. Gargoyle!
Must I always save everyone?"
He let out a string of language so jumbled, not even a scribe of the Siege could make sense of it, retrieved the rope, and threw it into the pit. Rory and I hauled ourselves out.
"Well," Rory lay on his back and wheezed, "at least we know we're in the right tunnel."
"That pike might have killed you." I leaned over him and ran my hand over the angry dent in his breastplate. "Gods, I could kiss your armorer."
"What about me?"
The gargoyle was seething.
"Is no one going to kiss me?"
Rory reached for his face, kissed his stone cheek.
"Help me get this off."
He winced.
"It's getting hard to breathe."
I helped the gargoyle undo the straps and hauled the breastplate off. Rory coughed, then went suddenly pale.
"Fuck."
He looked down at himself, at the tunnel floor.
"It's gone."
Panic touched his voice.
"My coin."
All three of us peered into the pit. The torrential current that had knocked us from our feet was now a steady drip, but the remains of it were still there. A black pool of water deeper than I was tall.
"All the armor comes off then," Rory said.
"You can't jump in there," I cried. "What about the pikes?" He stripped his gauntlets.
"I'll avoid them."
"There must be thousands of coins at the bottom of that pit." Off came his fanbrace, pauldrons.
"Gold ones, mine's stone."
"And that shiny new bruise on your chest? No doubt over your lungs. What about that?"
Next were his cuisses and greaves. "I'm a good swimmer."
"No, no, Bartholomew. Better that I take the risk. I am very good at saving people after all."
The gargoyle stretched his wings, suddenly heroic after his kiss.
"What exactly am I looking for again?"
Rory shot me a heavy-lidded glower. I bit down. "Do you really need the coin?"
"As much as you need your hammer and chisel."
Off came his chainmail. I wasn't going to win this. "Just be careful." Rory stood before me in his under armor, hooked my chin.
"It means something that you care enough to argue."
Breath fluttered out of me. Maybe I just like fighting with you.
I'm sure that's the only reason.
He brushed his thumb over my lips, dropped a kiss onto my mouth, pulled back, then kissed me again, like he couldn't help himself. The gargoyle sighed.
Really, Bartholomew, when are you going to put her out of her misery and tell her you love her?
Rory's dark eyes roamed my face. He grinned, then disappeared down the rope into the pit. For a time, there was nothing, just silence and the occasional sound of Rory in the water. The air in the tunnel was tepid, oppressive, and it was dark. So very dark. Still, I saw it. A shadow, darting past my periphery. Gargoyle? He was next to me, eerily still, as he looked down the tunnel.
I saw it too,
he whispered.
Is someone there? I called out. Is someone there?
My echo answered. I rubbed my eyes and tried to see into the impenetrable darkness. There was a clacking, so near I felt it in my chest. Clack, 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 clack. The echoes sounded. Clack, clack. Prickles rose on the back of my neck. Rory. I leaned over the pit and tugged the rope. The heart saw Weaver, Rory. But my voice never found him under the water. The gargoyle gasped.
Look, Bartholomew.
Out of the darkness, a shadow shifted. It came toward me, and I saw that it was small and on wings, pale and delicate as gossamer. A moth. It fluttered to my face, so close its wings stirred my lashes, then withdrew, fluttering back down the tunnel from whence it had come. Wait for Rory, I told the gargoyle, and stole after it. The tunnel drew close around me, swallowing me down its throat, and I made myself small to fit, keeping my gaze ever on the moth. There were more, I realized, dozens of moths on the walls of the tunnel, their pale, fluttering wings beckoning me. I was on my hands and knees now, the tunnel so constrictive I thought it might strangle me. But the moths kept fluttering, and I kept following, and suddenly I was spat out into a new cavern. I expected more darkness, and there was, but there was also the night sky. An opening in the cliff, roots and moonlight pouring in. I was in an oblong chamber with walls of crude rock. Hundreds of weavings hung like tapestries around me, and from the weavings, little white sacks hung, cocoons. Beneath them was a stone bench stationed against the wall, and upon it, a woman. A naked woman who lay supine and still, a shroud over her eyes. The world went still. One? I stumbled forward, banged my knees upon the stone bench. One! Mottled skin, grey lips, hands folded over her breasts, one lay upon the bench, her short brown hair fanning around her like a burned-out halo. When I touched her neck, searching for a pulse that was not there, her skin was as cold as stone. She looked like she was resting, but it wasn't rest. Whatever dream one walked in now brooked no awakening. She was lost, adrift, gone. No, it wasn't rest, it was sleep. Eternal. A cry ripped up my throat.
Shh,
came a woman's low, craggy voice.
Not all have woken.
I reeled. Out of shadow, slow and rigid, a figure came, her steps an ominous clack, clack against the cave floor.
It's been a long time since anyone's tripped my little snare, she said, or made it out of my pit.
She didn't wear a cloak like she had when she'd come to my room last night. It was the same face I'd seen. But it wasn't a woman. She looked like one of Ashling Cathedral's gargoyles, hewn entirely of limestone. She had wings tucked against jagged shoulder blades, a head like a goat, with gnarled four-digit paws for hands and hooves for feet, and her eyes, wide and pallid. They were just like the other omens, just like my bat-like gargoyles, just like mine. You... My armor clattered as I rose to my feet, standing in front of one. You're the Heartsaw Weaver?
Weaver I was. Heartsaw I am eternally.
The omen came forward, looking at neither me nor one. She was peering upon her wall, staring through stone eyes at the white silken cocoons attached to the thread.
You must be quiet. My moths are still sleeping, she rasped. Frail little things they are.
She began to hum, tuneless, cacophonous. I watched her, skin crawling. I did not want her to know how well she terrified me. Where is your loomstone, Omen?
No loom. No loomstone.
She nodded at the tapestry upon the wall.
Once I wove the finest garments in Traum, silk robes I made, but that was a long time ago.
She kept staring at her tapestry, and I followed her eyes. The cocoons had attached themselves to one particular weaving, as if the sprites favored it. It was fashioned in a beautiful braid that ran along the wall. Not woolen, but fine, thin, sheer, and pale. Gossamer. Diviner shrouds. I let out a wretched sound.
Hush,
the Heartsaw Weaver rasped, looking down at one.
They come to me every 10 years, Ashling's diviners, brought by gargoyles. Naked but for their shrouds, and always, always dead. Still, they smell of spring water.
Her throat hitched.
Taste of it too, I imagine.
I drew my hammer and chisel, blocking one with my body. If you touch her, I'll...
I said be quiet.
The omen showed her teeth, rows of cracked limestone.
I do not touch the diviners. I lay them down here in my caves, my own little underworld, where the sea air has its way with them. It is the best burial I can offer.
She looked over my shoulder at one's lifeless body.
She was your friend?
Tears burned my eyes, the cracks in my heart growing irreparably deeper. Yes.
Is that why you have come? To see with your own eyes the fate of diviners like yourself?
The weaver's eyes fell to my hammer and chisel.
Or have you been sent from your master upon the tour?
I sprang forward, leveling the tip of my chisel against her stone throat. I have no master, Omen. I come on my own volition to challenge you at your craft and claim your magic loomstone. A single strike, and I could split her like I had 1,000 stones before. To take magic, power, myself back from false gods like you. The Heartsaw Weaver did not withdraw her throat from my chisel's tip.
But I'm not a god, she whispered. Once I was not so different from you.
She blinked up at me with wide stone eyes.
Strange that you have no memory before Ashling, yet you still knew to claw yourself free from that horrible tour. How wonderful, how wretched it must have been, stepping out into the world, learning the story you'd been told was a lie.
Do not pretend you did not benefit from that lie, Weaver. Is not the gold wasting in your pit from Ashling's coffers? Did Divine does not drown, that you might earn it? Do folk not look for your signs in every bit of thread? I was a rabid dog, my words snapping barks. If I am wonderful and wretched for learning the truth of the omens, your hands are marked by the blood of my metamorphosis. The heart-sore weaver pressed her neck against my chisel, iron scraping against limestone.
Then you need not challenge me to my craft, daughter of Ashling. You have already beaten me by it.
She held out an empty stone paw, as if to show me she had nothing to lose or give.
Who better than a lost diviner to learn, then conquer love and heartbreak?
Moonlight crept through the fissure in the ceiling, casting the omen and me in an eerie silver glow.
Where is your loomstone?
I asked again, my voice dangerously soft.
That, I fear, is a long story.
I have time. She grinned then, shadows cutting across her inhuman face.
More than you realize.
The heart-sore weaver took a step back from my chisel's tip.
You know by now there is magic in the world. The stone upon the tor, its water, the spring you drank from, drowned in, is the mother of that magic. From it, five objects were hewn. A coin, an inkwell, an oar, a chime. She sighed, and a loomstone.
I waited.
What you do not know, perhaps, is we whom you call omens had no sway over that magic when the objects were made. I did not choose my loomstone's power, and neither did she who carved it for me, yet, strangely, it suited me. Magic is like a god in that way, all-knowing and most effective when not fully understood.
I hated talk of gods. What does your loomstone do? I said, clipped.
I could slip my finger into the hole in the center of it. If the stone's face was pointed outward, I would be transported, made invisible. I could jump through the walls of this cave, travel 20 feet in the air. All I had to do was know in my mind where I wanted to go. So long as the distance was not more than my line of sight, I could get there. Brilliant magic it was. But when I turned the loom stone over, its face pointed inward.
How burdened she suddenly looked, her head lowered, as if weighed down. Even her eyes seemed too heavy to lift.
I was transported, not in body, but in mind. Perhaps it's because I'm a weaver, and a tapestry is like a memory brought to life. I always know what I was feeling in that moment, what I was thinking, when I look back on something I've woven. The loom stone was no different. I'd slip it on my finger, and it gave me back the most important thing I'd lost.
Her eyes lifted, found my face.
My memory. If I wished to, I could recall who I was before I was the heart-sore weaver.
Her head turned as she surveyed me.
Tell me, diviner, do you recall anything before you tasted Ashling's waters?
I could tell she already knew the answer.
No.
She nodded.
Losing something is painful. Sometimes finding what we've lost is just as agonizing.
I looked down at one, lifeless beneath the tapestry, whispered like I was telling her a story before bed.
You can never really go home.
No, you cannot. The heart-sore weaver looked out into the darkness of her cavern.
But I did not want to look back at who I was. I was too enthralled with being an omen. For many years, I did not use the loom stone in that way. I kept to my hamlet, as we omens said we would. For decades, I sowed the seeds of gods and signs within the cliffs of Belladine, used my loom stone to appear and vanish, to kill sprites. I gave Traum something to rally behind, to believe in. She began to pace. Then, on a year without mark, she came. The omens and I, we all needed the Tor's spring water to live. Not much and not often, but we needed it. Sometimes the water came in a flask at the hands of her little foundling, but this time she brought it herself. We drank it together, like old friends. Then she asked me to make her a silk robe. The Heartsore Weaver reached out, pet the gossamer weaving upon the wall, its delicate fabric snagging against one of her stone claws. A diviner is not so different from a silkworm, she said. That is what I will call my foundling, a diviner. He came into the world vulnerable, fell into dreamless sleep. I wrapped him in my arms, put water to his lips, and he awoke, a moth. Her stone eyes flashed, strange, special, new. I want him to look the part. My throat tightened. You're talking about the abbess and the foundling child from her story. I knew her before she was abbess of anything. The Heartsore Weaver's gaze dropped to my hammer and chisel. When she was but a stonemason who wore a shroud over her face, a craftsman like me. I made her the robe. When I travelled to the Tor to deliver it, the first stones of a cathedral had been laid. Many years later, she came to see me again, asking for 5 more robes. This time, there was no foundling child at her heels, but a stone gargoyle. The Heartsore Weaver rolled her shoulders, the sound inhuman, like rocks scraping together. More time passed. One by one, I made her the robe she'd asked for. But by the time I was on the 6th and final robe, I'd grown weary, lonely. So I slipped the loom stone back on my finger, facing inward, hoping to be comforted by memories of my past. She stopped pacing, shut her eyes. Only they were a torment. I remembered my real name, my mother and brother, my wife and her parents, my naughty yellow cat. I remembered what it was like to love and be loved, to be careful and also carefree, to be good and bad, to be human. But I'd spent too much time sustaining the charade of the omens. When I finally went home to see my loved ones, most had died of old age. Those who remained looked upon my stone eyes in terror. They'd thought me missing, mourned me, let go of me. Soon they too died, and I was alone with naught but my memories. The weaver seemed lost in her story, her digits moving in strange patterns. Had she fingers and not claws, I might have thought her plaiting an invisible tapestry. I withheld the final robe. When she came for it, I told her I no longer wished to be an omen, that I didn't have it in me to live forever, play acting as a god.